Flowers for Algernon, Disc 6.
June 24th. Today I went on a strange kind of anti-intellectual binge. If I had dared to, I would have gotten drunk, but after the experience with Faye, I knew it would be dangerous. So instead, I went to Times Square, from movie house to movie house, immersing myself in westerns and horror movies, the way I used to. Each time sitting through the picture, I would find myself whipped with guilt. I'd walk out in the middle of the picture and wander into another one. I told myself I was looking for something in the make-believe screen world that was missing from my new life. Then, in a sudden intuition, right outside the Kino Amusement Center, I knew it wasn't the movies I wanted, but the audiences. I wanted to be with the people around me in the darkness. The walls between people are thin here, and if I listen quietly, I hear what's going on. Greenwich Village is like that, too. Not just being close, because I don't feel it in a crowded elevator or on the subway during the rush, but on a hot night when everyone is out walking or sitting in the theater, there is a rustling, and for a moment I brush against someone and sense the connection between the branch and trunk and the deep root. At such moments, my flesh is thin and tight, and the unbearable hunger to be part of it drives me out to search in the dark corners and blind alleys of the night. Usually, when I'm exhausted from walking, I go back to the apartment and drop off into a deep sleep. But tonight, instead of going up to my own place, I went to the diner. There was a new dishwasher, a boy of about 16, and there was something familiar about him, his movements, the look in his eyes. And then, clearing away the table behind me, he dropped some dishes. They crashed to the floor, shattering and sending bits of white china under the tables. He stood there, dazed and frightened, holding the empty tray in his hand. The whistles and catcalls from the customers, cries of, "Hey, there go the prophets! Mazel tov!" And, "Well, he didn't work here very long," which invariably seems to follow the breaking of dishware in a public restaurant, confused him. When the owner came to see what the excitement was about, the boy cowered, threw up his arms as if to ward off a blow. All right, you dope," shouted the man. "Don't just stand there. Get the broom and sweep up that mess. A broom. A broom, you idiot. It's in the kitchen. Sweep up all the pieces." When the boy saw that he was not going to be punished, his frightened expression disappeared, and he smiled and hummed as he came back with the broom. A few of the rowdier customers kept up the remarks, amusing themselves at his expense. "Here, sonny, over here, there's a nice piece behind you.
Come on, do it again.
He's not so dumb, it's easier to break him than to wash him." As the boy's vacant eyes moved across the crowd of amused onlookers, he slowly mirrored their smiles, and finally broke into an uncertain grin at the joke which he did not understand. I felt sick inside as I looked at his dull, vacuous smile, the wide, bright eyes of a child, uncertain but eager to please, and I realized what I had recognized in him. They were laughing at him because he was retarded. And at first I had been amused along with the rest. Suddenly I was furious at myself and all those who were smirking at him. I wanted to pick up the dishes and throw them. I wanted to smash their laughing faces. I jumped up and shouted, "Shut up! Leave him alone! He can't understand! He can't help what he is, but for God's sake have some respect! He's a human being!" The restaurant grew silent. I cursed myself for losing control and creating a scene, and I tried not to look at the boy as I paid my check and walked out without touching my food. I felt ashamed for both of us. How strange it is that people of honest feelings and sensibility, who wouldn't take advantage of a man born without arms or legs or eyes, how such people think nothing of abusing a man born with low intelligence. It infuriated me to remember that not too long ago I, like this boy, had foolishly played the clown. And I had almost forgotten. Only a short time ago, I learned that people laughed at me. Now I can see that unknowingly I joined them in laughing at myself. That hurts most of all. I've often reread my early progress reports and seen the illiteracy, the childish naivete, the mind of low intelligence peering from a dark room through the keyhole at the dazzling light outside. In my dreams and memories, I've seen Charlie smiling happily and uncertainly at what people around him were saying. Even in my dullness, I knew I was inferior. Other people had something I lacked, something denied me. In my mental blindness, I had believed it was somehow connected with the ability to read and write, and I was sure that if I could get those skills, I would have intelligence, too. Even a feeble-minded man wants to be like other men. A child may not know how to feed itself or what to eat, yet it knows hunger. This day was good for me. I've got to stop this childish worrying about myself, my past, and my future. Let me give something of myself to others. I've got to use my knowledge and skills to work in the field of increasing human intelligence. Who is better equipped? Who else has lived in both worlds? Tomorrow I'm going to get in touch with the board of directors at the Wellberg Foundation and ask for permission to do some independent work on the project. If they'll let me, I may be able to help them. I have some ideas. There is so much that can be done with this technique, if it's perfected. If I could be made into a genius, what about the more than 5 million mentally retarded in the United States? What about the countless millions all over the world and those yet unborn destined to be retarded? What fantastic levels might be achieved by using this technique on normal people, on geniuses? There are so many doors to open. I am impatient to apply my own knowledge and skills to the problem. I've got to make them all see that this is something important for me to do. I'm sure the Foundation will grant me permission. But I can't be alone anymore. I have to tell Alice about it. June 25th. I called Alice today. I was nervous, and I must have sounded incoherent, but it was good to hear her voice, and she sounded happy to hear from me. She agreed to see me, and I took a taxi uptown, impatient at the slowness with which we moved. Before I could knock, she opened the door and threw her arms around me. "Charlie, we've been so worried about you. I had horrible visions of you dead in an alleyway or wandering around Skid Row with amnesia. Why didn't you let us know you were all right? You could have done that."
"Don't scold me. I had to be alone for a while to find some answers."
"Come in the kitchen. I'll make some coffee. What have you been doing?"
"Days I've been thinking, reading, and writing. And nights, wandering in search of myself. And I've discovered that Charlie is watching me."
"Don't talk like that," she shuddered. "This business about being watched isn't real. You've built it up in your mind."
"I can't help feeling that I'm not me. I've usurped his place and locked him out the way they locked me out of the bakery. What I mean to say is that Charlie Gordon exists in the past, and the past is real. You can't put up a new building on a site until you destroy the old one. And the old Charlie can't be destroyed. He exists. At first, I was searching for him. I went to see my father. All I wanted to do was prove that Charlie existed as a person in the past so that I could justify my own existence. I was insulted when Niemer said he created me. But I've discovered that not only did Charlie exist in the past, he exists now. In me and around me. He's been coming between us all along. I thought my intelligence created the barrier, my pompous, foolish pride, the feeling we had nothing in common because I had gone beyond you. You put that idea into my head. But that's not it. It's Charlie, the little boy who's afraid of women because of things his mother did to him. Don't you see? All these months, while I've been growing up intellectually, I've still had the emotional wiring of the childlike Charlie. And every time I came close to you or thought about making love to you, there was a short circuit. I was excited, and my voice pounded at her until she began to quiver. Her face became flushed. "Charlie," she whispered, "can't I do anything? Can't I help?" "I think I've changed during these weeks away from the lab," I said. "I couldn't see how to do it at first, but tonight, while I was wandering around the city, it came to me. The foolish thing was trying to solve the problem all by myself. But the deeper I get tangled up in this mass of dreams and memories, the more I realize that emotional problems can't be solved as intellectual problems are. That's what I discovered about myself last night. I told myself I was wandering around like a lost soul, and then I saw that I was lost. Somehow, I've become separated emotionally from everyone and everything. And what I was really searching for out there in the dark streets, the last damn place I could ever find it, was a way to make myself a part of people again, emotionally, while still retaining my freedom intellectually. I've got to grow up. For me, it means everything. I talked on and on, spewing out of myself every doubt and fear that bubbled to the surface. She was my sounding board, and she sat there, hypnotized. I felt myself grow warm, feverish, until I thought my body was on fire. I was burning out the infection in front of someone I cared about, and that made all the difference. But it was too much for her. What had started as trembling became tears. The picture over the couch caught my eye, the cringing, red-cheeked maiden, and I wondered what Alice was feeling just then. I knew she would give herself to me, and I wanted her. But what about Charlie? Charlie might not interfere if I wanted to make love to Faye. He would probably just stand in the doorway and watch. But the moment I came close to Alice, he panicked. Why was he afraid to let me love Alice? She sat on the couch looking at me, waiting to see what I would do. And what could I do? I wanted to take her in my arms and... As I began to think of it, the warning came. "Are you all right, Charlie? You're so pale." I sat down on the couch beside her. "Just a little dizzy. It'll pass." But I knew it would only get worse as long as Charlie felt there was danger I'd make love to her. And then I got the idea. It disgusted me at first, but suddenly I realized the only way to overcome this paralysis was to outwit him. If for some reason Charlie was afraid of Alice but not of Faye, then I would turn out the lights and pretend I was making love to Faye. He'd never know the difference. It was wrong, disgusting, but if it worked, it would break Charlie's stranglehold on my emotions. I would know afterwards that I had loved Alice, and that this was the only way. "I'm all right now. Let's sit in the dark for a while," I said, turning off the lights and waiting to collect myself. It wasn't going to be easy. I had to convince myself, visualize Faye, hypnotize myself into believing that the woman sitting beside me was Faye. And even if he separated himself from me to watch from outside my body, it would do him no good, because the room would be dark. I waited for some sign that he suspected, the warning symptoms of panic. But nothing. I felt alert and calm. I put my arm around her. "Charlie, I..." "Don't talk!" I snapped, and she shrank from me. "Please," I reassured her, "don't say anything. Just let me hold you quietly in the dark." I brought her close to me, and there, under the darkness of my closed lids, I conjured up the picture of Faye, with her long blonde hair and fair skin. Faye, as I had seen her last, beside me. I kissed Faye's hair, Faye's throat, and finally came to rest upon Faye's lips. I felt Faye's arms stroking the muscles on my back, my shoulders, and the tightness inside me built up as it had never before done for a woman. I caressed her slowly at first, and then with impatient, mounting excitement that would soon tell. The hairs on my neck began to tingle. Someone else was in the room, peering through the darkness, trying to see. And feverishly I thought the name over and over to myself. Fay. 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 I imagined her face sharply and clearly so that nothing could come between us. And then, as she gripped me closer, I cried out and pushed her away. Charlie! I couldn't see Alice's face, but her gasp mirrored the shock. No, Alice, I can't. You don't understand. I jumped up from the couch and turned on the light. I almost expected to see him standing there. But of course not. We were alone. It was all in my mind. Alice was lying there, her blouse open where I'd unbuttoned it, her face flushed, eyes wide in disbelief. I love you, the words choked out of me, but I can't do it. Something I can't explain, but if I hadn't stopped, I would hate myself for the rest of my life. Don't ask me to explain or you'll hate me too. It has to do with Charlie. For some reason, he won't let me make love to you. She looked away and buttoned her blouse. It was different tonight, she said. You didn't get nausea or panic or anything like that. You wanted me. Yes, I wanted you, but I wasn't really making love to you. I was going to use you, in a way, but I can't explain. I don't understand it myself. Let's just say I'm not ready yet. And I can't fake it or cheat or pretend it's all right when it's not. It's just another blind alley. I got up to go. Charlie, don't run away again. I'm through running. I've got work to do. Tell them I'll be back to the lab in a few days as soon as I get control of myself. I left the apartment in a frenzy. Downstairs in front of the building, I stood, not knowing which way to go. No matter which path I took, I got a shock that meant another mistake. Every path was blocked. But God, everything I did, everywhere I turned, doors were closed to me. There was no place to enter. No street, no room, no woman. Finally, I stumbled down into the subway and took it down to 49th Street. Not many people, but there was a blonde with long hair who reminded me of Faye. Heading toward the crosstown bus, I passed a liquor store, and without thinking about it, I went in and bought a fifth of gin. While I waited for the bus, I opened the bottle in the bag, as I had seen bums do, and I took a long, deep drink. It burned all the way down, but it felt good. I took another, just a sip, and by the time the bus came, I was bathed in a powerful, tingling sensation. I didn't take any more. I didn't want to get drunk now. When I got to the apartment, I knocked at Faye's door. There was no answer. I opened the door and looked in. She hadn't come in yet, but all the lights were on in the place. She didn't give a damn about anything. Why couldn't I be that way? I went to my own place to wait. I undressed, took a shower, and put on a robe. I prayed that this wouldn't be one of the nights that someone came home with her. About 2:30 in the morning, I heard her coming up the steps. I took my bottle, climbed out onto the fire escape, and slipped over to her window just as her front door opened. I hadn't intended to crouch there and watch. I was going to tap on the window. But as I raised my hand to make my presence known, I saw her kick her shoes off and twirl around happily. She went to the mirror and slowly, piece by piece, began to pull off her clothes in a private striptease. I took another drink, but I couldn't let her know I had been watching her. I went through my own apartment without turning on the lights. At first, I thought of inviting her over to my place, but everything was too neat and orderly, too many straight lines to erase, and I knew it wouldn't work here. So I went out into the hallway. I knocked at her door, softly at first, and then louder. "Door's open!" she shouted. She was in her underwear, lying on the floor, arms outstretched and legs up against the couch. She tilted her head back and looked at me upside down.
"Charlie, darling, why are you standing on your head?"
"Never mind," I said, pulling the bottle out of the paper bag. "The lines and boxes are too straight, and I thought you'd join me in erasing some of them." Best stuff in the world for that, she said. If you concentrate on the warm spot that starts in the pit of your stomach, all the lines begin to melt. That's what's happening. Wonderful! She jumped to her feet. Me too. I danced with too many squares tonight. Let's melt them all down. She picked up a glass and I filled it for her. As she drank, I slipped my arm around her and toyed with the skin of her bare back. Hey there, boy. Whoa. What's up? Me? I was waiting for you to come home. She backed away. Oh, wait a minute, Charlie boy. We've been through all this before. You know it doesn't do any good. I mean, you know I think a lot of you, and I'd drag you into bed in a minute if I thought there was a chance. But I don't want to get all worked up for nothing. It's not fair, Charlie. It'll be different tonight, I swear it. Before she could protest, I had her in my arms, kissing her, caressing her, overwhelming her with all the built-up excitement that was ready to tear me apart. I tried to unhook her brassiere, but I pulled too hard and the hook tore out. For God's sake, Charlie, my bra! Don't worry about your bra, I choked, helping her to take it off. I'll buy you a new one. I'm going to make up for the other times. I'm going to make love to you all night long. She pulled away from me. Charlie, I've never heard you talk like that, and stop looking at me as if you want to swallow me whole. She swept up a blouse from one of the chairs and held it in front of her. Now you're making me feel undressed. I want to make love to you. Tonight I can do it, I know it. I feel it. Don't turn me away, Faye. Here, she whispered. Have another drink. I took one and poured another for her, and while she drank it, I covered her shoulder and neck with kisses. She began to breathe heavily as my excitement communicated itself to her. God, Charlie, if you get me started and disappoint me again, I don't know what I'll do. I'm human too, you know. I pulled her down beside me on the couch, on top of the pile of her clothing and underthings. Not here on the couch, Charlie, she said, struggling to her feet. Let's go to bed. Here, I insisted, pulling the blouse away from her. She looked down at me, set her glass on the floor, and stepped out of her underwear. She stood there in front of me, nude. I'll turn out the lights, she whispered. No, I said, pulling her down onto the couch again. I want to look at you. She kissed me deeply and held me tightly in her arms. Just don't disappoint me this time, Charlie. You'd better not. Her body moved slowly, reaching for me, and I knew that this time nothing would interfere. I knew what to do and how to do it. She gasped and sighed and called my name. For one moment, I had the cold feeling he was watching. Over the arm of the couch, I caught a glimpse of his face staring back at me through the dark beyond the window, where just a few minutes earlier I had been crouching. A switch in perception, and I was out on the fire escape again, watching a man and a woman inside making love on the couch. Then, with a violent effort of the will, I was back on the couch with her, aware of her body and my own urgency and potency, and I saw the face against the window, hungrily watching. And I thought to myself, go ahead, you poor bastard. Watch, I don't give a damn anymore. And his eyes went wide as he watched. June 29th. Before I go back to the lab, I'm going to finish the projects I've started since I left the convention. I phoned Lansdorf at the New Institute for Advanced Study about the possibility of utilizing the pair production nuclear photo effect for exploratory work in biophysics. At first he thought I was a crackpot, but after I pointed out the flaws in his article in the New Institute Journal, he kept me on the phone for nearly an hour. He wants me to come to the Institute to discuss my ideas with his group. I might take him up on it after I've finished my work at the lab, if there's time. That's the problem, of course. I don't know how much time I have. A month? A year? The rest of my life? That depends on what I find out about the psychophysical side effects of the experiment. June 30th. I've stopped wandering the streets now that I have Faye. I've given her a key to my place. She kids me about my locking the door, and I kid her about the mess her place is in. She's warned me not to try to change her. Her husband divorced her 5 years ago because she couldn't be bothered about picking things up and taking care of her home. That's the way she is about most things that seem unimportant to her. She just can't or won't bother. The other day, I discovered a stack of parking tickets in a corner behind a chair. There must have been 40 or 50 of them. When she came in with the beer, I asked her why she was collecting them. "Those," she laughed. "As soon as my ex-husband sends me my goddamn check, I've got to pay some of them. You have no idea how bad I feel about those tickets. I keep them behind that chair because otherwise I get an attack of guilt feelings every time I see them. But what is a girl supposed to do? Everywhere I go, they've got signs all over the place. Don't park here, don't park there. I just can't be bothered stopping to read a sign every time I want to get out of the car." So I've promised I won't try to change her. She's exciting to be with. A great sense of humor. But most of all, she's a free and independent spirit. The only thing that may become wearing after a while is her craze for dancing. We've been out every night this week until 2 or 3 in the morning. I don't have that much energy left. It's not love, but she's important to me. I find myself listening for her footsteps down the hallway whenever she's been out. Charlie has stopped watching us. July 5th. I dedicated my first piano concerto to Faye. She was excited by the idea of having something dedicated to her, but I don't think she really liked it. Just goes to show that you can't have everything you want in one woman. One more argument for polygamy. The important thing is that Faye is bright and good-hearted. I learned today why she ran out of money so early this month. The week before she met me, she had befriended a girl she'd met at the Stardust Ballroom. When the girl told Faye she had no family in the city, was broke, and had no place to sleep, Faye invited her to move in. 2 days later, the girl found the $232 that Faye kept in her dresser drawer and disappeared with the money. Faye hadn't reported it to the police, and as it turned out, she didn't even know the girl's last name. "What good would it do to notify the police?" she wanted to know. "I mean, this poor bitch must have needed the money pretty badly to do it. I'm not going to ruin her life over a few hundred bucks. I'm not rich or anything, but I'm not going after her skin, if you know what I mean." I knew what she meant. I have never met anyone as open and trusting as Faye is. She's what I need most of all right now. I've been starved for simple human contact. July 8th. Not much time for work between the nightly club hopping and the morning hangovers. It was only with aspirin and something Faye concocted for me that I was able to finish my linguistic analysis of Urdu verb forms and send the paper to the International Linguistics Bulletin. It will send the linguists back to India with their tape recorders, because it undermines the critical superstructure of their methodology. I can't help but admire the structural linguists who have carved out for themselves a linguistic discipline based on the deterioration of written communication. Another case of men devoting their lives to studying more and more about less and less, filling volumes and libraries with the subtle linguistic analysis of the grunt. Nothing wrong with that, but it shouldn't be used as an excuse to destroy the stability of language. Alice called today to find out when I am coming back to work at the lab. I told her I wanted to finish the projects I had started, and that I was hoping to get permission from the Wellberg Foundation for my own special study. She's right, though. I've got to take time into consideration. Faye still wants to go out dancing all the time. Last night started out with us drinking and dancing at the White Horse Club, and from there to Benny's Hideaway, and then on to the Pink Slipper. And after that, I don't remember many of the places, but we danced until I was ready to drop. My tolerance for liquor must have increased, because I was pretty far gone before Charlie made his appearance. I can only recall him doing a silly tap dance on the stage of the Alakazam Club. He got a great hand before the manager threw us out, and Faye said everyone thought I was a wonderful comedian and everyone liked my moron act. What the hell happened then? I know I strained my back. I thought it was from all the dancing, but Faye says I fell off the goddamn couch. Algernon's behavior is becoming erratic again. Minnie seems to be afraid of him. July 9th. A terrible thing happened today. Algernon bit Faye. I had warned her against playing with him, but she always liked to feed him. Usually, when she came into his room, he'd perk up and run to her. Today it was different. He was at the far side, curled up into a white puff. When she put her hand in through the top trap door, he cringed and forced himself back into the corner. She tried to coax him by opening the barrier to the maze, and before I could tell her to leave him alone, she made the mistake of trying to pick him up. He bit her thumb. Then he glared at both of us and scurried back into the maze. We found Minnie at the other end, in the reward box. She was bleeding from a gash in her chest, but she was alive. As I reached in to take her out, Algernon came into the reward box and snapped at me. His teeth caught my sleeve, and he hung on until I shook him loose. He calmed down after that. I observed him for more than an hour afterward. He seems listless and confused, and though he still learns new problems without external rewards, his performance is peculiar. Instead of the careful, determined movements down the maze corridors, his actions are rushed and out of control. Time and again he turns into a corner too quickly and crashes into a barrier. There is a strange sense of urgency in his behavior. I hesitate to make a snap judgment. It could be many things, but now I've got to get him back to the lab. Whether or not I hear from the Foundation about my special grant, I'm going to call Niemer in the morning. Progress Report 15, July 12th. Niemer, Strauss, Bert, and a few of the others on the project were waiting for me in the psych office. They tried to make me feel welcome, but I could see how anxious Bert was to take Algernon, and I turned him over. No one said anything, but I knew that Niemer would not soon forgive me for going over his head and getting in touch with the Foundation. But it had been necessary. Before I returned to Beekman, I had to be assured they would permit me to begin an independent study of the project. Too much time would be wasted if I had to account to Niemer for everything I did. He had been informed of the Foundation's decision, and my reception was a cold and formal one. He held out his hand, but there was no smile on his face. "Charlie," he said, "we're all glad you're back and going to work with us. Jason called and told me the Foundation was putting you to work on the project. This staff and the lab are at your disposal. The Computer Center has assured us that your work will have priority. And, of course, if I can help in any way..." He was doing his utmost to be cordial, but I could see by his face that he was skeptical. After all, what experience did I have with experimental psychology? What did I know about the techniques that he had spent so many years developing? Well, as I say, he appeared cordial and willing to suspend judgment. There isn't much else he can do now. If I don't come up with an explanation for Algernon's behavior, all of his work goes down the drain. But if I solve the problem, I bring in the whole crew with me. I went into the lab where Bert was watching Algernon in one of the multiple problem boxes. He sighed and shook his head. "He's forgotten a lot. Most of his complex responses seem to have been wiped out. He's solving problems on a much more primitive level than I would have expected." "In what way?" I asked. "Well, in the past he was able to figure out simple patterns. In that blind door run, for example. Every other door, every third door, red doors only, or the green doors only. But now he's been through that run 3 times, and he's still using trial and error."
"Could it be because he was away from the lab for so long?"
"Could be. We'll let him get used to things again and see how he works out tomorrow." I had been in the lab many times before this, But now I was here to learn everything it had to offer. I had to absorb procedures in a few days that the others had taken years to learn. Bert and I spent 4 hours going through the lab section by section as I tried to familiarize myself with the total picture. When we were all through, I noticed one door we hadn't looked into. "What's in there?" "The freeze and the incinerator." He pushed open the heavy door and turned on the light. "We freeze our specimens before we dispose of them in the incinerator. It helps cut down the odors if we control decomposition." He turned to leave, but I stood there for a moment. "Not Algernon," I said. "Look, if and when... I mean, I don't want him dumped in there. Give him to me. I'll take care of him myself." He didn't laugh. He just nodded. Niemer had told him that from now on, I could have anything I wanted. Time was the barrier. If I was going to find out the answers for myself, I had to get to work immediately. I got lists of books from Bert and notes from Strauss and Niemer. Then, on the way out, I got a strange notion. "Tell me," I asked Niemer. "I just got a look at your incinerator for disposing of experimental animals. What plans have been made for me?" My question stunned him. "What do you mean?" "I'm sure that from the beginning you planned for all exigencies. So what happens to me?" When he was silent, I insisted. "I have a right to know everything that pertains to the experiment, and that includes my future." "No reason why you shouldn't know." He paused and lit an already lit cigarette. "You understand, of course, that from the beginning we had the highest hopes of permanence, and we still do. We definitely do." "I'm sure of that," I said. "Of course, taking you on in this experiment was a serious responsibility. I don't know how much you remember or how much you've pieced together about things in the beginning of the project, but we tried to make it clear to you that there was a strong chance it might be only temporary." "I had that written down in my progress reports at the time," I agreed, "though I didn't understand at the time what you meant by it, but that's beside the point because I'm aware of it now." "Well, we decided to risk it with you," he went on, "because we felt there was very little chance of doing you any serious harm, and we were sure there was a great chance of doing you some good." "You don't have to justify that." "But you realize we had to get permission from someone in your immediate family. You were incompetent to agree to this yourself." "I know all about that. You're talking about my sister, Norma. I read about it in the papers. From what I remember of her, I imagine she'd have given you approval for my execution." He raised his eyebrows, but let it pass. "Well, as we told her, in the event that the experiment failed, we couldn't send you back to the bakery or to that room where you came from." "Why not?" "For one thing, you might not be the same. Surgery and injections of hormones might have had effects not immediately evident. Experiences since the operation might have left their mark on you. I mean, possibly emotional disturbances to complicate the retardation. You couldn't possibly be the same kind of person."
"That's great. As if one cross weren't enough to bear."
"And for another thing, there's no way of knowing if you would go back to the same mental level. There might be regression to an even more primitive level of functioning." He was letting me have the worst of it, getting the weight off his mind. "I might as well know everything," I said, "while I'm still in a position to have some say about it. What plans have you made for me?" He shrugged. "The Foundation has arranged to send you to the Warren State Home and Training School." "What the hell?" "Part of the agreement with your sister was that all the home's fees would be assumed by the Foundation, and you would receive a regular monthly income to be used for your personal needs for the rest of your life."
"But why there? I was always able to manage on my own on the outside. Even when they committed me there after Uncle Herman died, Donner was able to get me out right away to work and live on the outside. Why do I have to go back?"
"If you can take care of yourself on the outside, you won't have to stay in Warren.
The less severe cases are permitted to live off the grounds. But we had to make provision for you, just in case. He was right. There was nothing for me to complain about. They had thought of everything. Warren was the logical place, the deep freeze where I could be put away for the rest of my days. At least it's not the incinerator, I said. What? Never mind, a private joke. Then I thought of something. Tell me, is it possible to visit Warren? I mean, go through the place and look it over as a visitor? Yes, I think they have people coming down all the time, regular tours through the home as a kind of public relations thing. But why? Because I want to see. I've got to know what's going to happen while I'm still enough in control to be able to do something about it. See if you can arrange it as soon as possible. I could see he was upset about the idea of my visiting Warren, as if I were ordering my coffin to sit in before I died. But then, I can't blame him, because he doesn't realize that finding out who I really am, the meaning of my total existence, involves knowing the possibilities of my future as well as my past, where I'm going as well as where I've been. Although we know the end of the maze holds death, and it is something I have not always known. Not long ago, the adolescent in me thought death could happen only to other people. I see now that the path I choose through that maze makes me what I am. I am not only a thing, but also a way of being, one of many ways. And knowing the paths I have followed and the ones left to take will help me understand what I am becoming. That evening, and for the next few days, I immersed myself in psychology texts. Clinical, personality, psychometrics, learning, experimental psychology, animal psychology, physiological psychology, behaviorist, gestalt, analytical, functional, dynamic, organismic, and all the rest of the ancient and modern factions, schools, and systems of thought. The depressing thing is that so many of the ideas on which our psychologists base their beliefs about human intelligence, memory, and learning are all wishful thinking. Faye wants to come down and visit the lab, but I've told her not to. All I need now is for Alice and Faye to run into each other. I have enough to worry about without that. Progress Report 16, July 14th. It was a bad day to go out to Warren, gray and drizzly, and that may account for the depression that grips me when I think about it. Or perhaps I'm kidding myself, and it was the idea of possibly being sent there that bothered me. I borrowed Bert's car. Alice wanted to come along, but I had to see it alone. I didn't tell Faye I was going. It was an hour and a half drive out to the farmland community of Warren, Long Island, and I had no trouble finding the place. A sprawling gray estate revealed to the world only by an entrance of two concrete pillars flanking a narrow side road and a well-polished brass plate with the name Warren State Home and Training School. The roadside sign said 15 miles per hour, so I drove slowly past the blocks of buildings looking for the administrative offices. A tractor came across the meadow in my direction, and in addition to the man at the wheel, there were two others hanging on the rear. I stuck out my head and called, "Can you tell me where Mr. Winslow's office is?" The driver stopped the tractor and pointed to the left and ahead. "Main hospital, turn left and bear to your right." I couldn't help noticing the staring young man riding at the rear of the tractor, hanging onto a handrail. He was unshaven, and there was the trace of an empty smile. He had on a sailor's hat, with the brim pulled down childishly to shield his eyes, although there was no sun out. I caught his glance for a moment, his eyes wide, inquiring, but I had to look away. When the tractor started forward again, I could see in the rearview mirror that he was looking after me, curiously. It upset me, because he reminded me of Charlie. I was startled to find the head psychologist so young, a tall, lean man with a tired look on his face, but his steady blue eyes suggested a strength behind the youthful expression.
He drove me around the grounds in his own car and pointed out the recreation hall, hospital, school, administrative offices, and the two-story brick buildings he called cottages where the patients lived. "I didn't notice a fence around Warren," I said. "No, only a gate at the entrance and hedges to keep out curiosity seekers." "But how do you keep them from wandering off, from leaving the grounds?" He shrugged and smiled. "We can't, really. Some of them do wander off, but most of them return." "Don't you go after them?" He looked at me as if trying to guess what was behind my question. "No. If they get into trouble, we soon know about it from the people in town, or the police bring them back." "And if not?" "If we don't hear about them or from them, we assume they've made some satisfactory adjustment on the outside. You've got to understand, Mr. Gordon, this isn't a prison. We are required by the state to make all reasonable efforts to get our patients back, but we're not equipped to closely supervise 4,000 people at all times. The ones who manage to leave are all high moron types. Not that we're getting many of those anymore. Now we get more of the brain-damaged cases who require constant custodial care. But the high morons can move around more freely, and after a week or so on the outside, most of them come back when they find there's nothing for them out there. The world doesn't want them, and they soon know it." We got out of the car and walked over to one of the cottages. Inside, the walls were white tile, and the building had a disinfectant smell to it. The first-floor lobby opened up to a recreation room, filled with some 75 boys, sitting around waiting for the lunch bell to be sounded. What caught my eye immediately was one of the bigger boys on a chair in the corner, cradling one of the other boys, 14 or 15 years old, cuddling him in his arms. They all turned to look as we entered, and some of the bolder ones came over and stared at me. "Don't mind them," he said, seeing my expression. "They won't hurt you." The woman in charge of the floor, a large-boned, handsome woman with rolled-up shirt sleeves and a denim apron over her starched white skirt, came up to us. At her belt was a ring of keys that jangled as she moved, and only when she turned did I see that the left side of her face was covered by a large, wine-colored birthmark. "Didn't expect any company today, Ray," she said. "You usually bring your visitors on Thursdays." "This is Mr. Gordon, Thelma, from Beekman University. He just wants to look around and get an idea of the work we're doing here." "I knew it wouldn't make any difference with you, Thelma. Any day is all right with you." "Yeah," she laughed strongly. "But Wednesday we turn the mattresses. It smells a lot better here on Thursday." I noticed that she kept to my left so that the blotch on her face was hidden. She took me through the dormitory, the laundry, the supply rooms, and the dining hall, now set and waiting for the food to be delivered from the central commissary. She smiled as she talked, and her expression and the hair piled in a bun high on her head made her look like a Lautrec dancer, but she never looked straight at me. I wondered what it would be like living here with her to watch over me. "They're pretty good here in this building," she said. "But you know what it is. 300 boys, 75 on a floor, and only 5 of us to look after them. It's not easy to keep them under control, but it's a lot better than the untidy cottages. The staff there doesn't last very long. With babies, you don't mind so much, but when they get to be adults and still can't care for themselves, it can be a nasty mess." "You seem to be a very nice person," I said. "The boys are fortunate to have you as their house supervisor." She laughed heartily, still looking straight ahead, and showed her white teeth. "No better or worse than the rest. I'm very fond of my boys. It's not easy work, but it's rewarding when you think how much they need you." The smile left her for a moment. "Normal kids grow up too soon, stop needing you, go off on their own, forget who loved them and took care of them. But these children need all you can give. All of their lives." She laughed again, embarrassed at her seriousness. "It's hard work here, but worth it." Back downstairs, where Winslow was waiting for us, the dinner bell sounded, and the boys filed into the dining room. I noticed that the big boy who had held the smaller one in his lap was now leading him to the table by the hand. "Quite a thing," I said, nodding in that direction. Winslow nodded, too. "Jerry's the big one, and that's Dusty. We see that sort of thing often here. When there's no one else who has time for them, sometimes they know enough to seek human contact and affection from each other." As we passed one of the other cottages on our way to the school, I heard a shriek, followed by a wailing, picked up and echoed by two or three other voices. There were bars on the windows. Winslow looked uncomfortable for the first time that morning. "Special security cottage," he explained. "Emotionally disturbed retardates. When there's a chance they'll harm themselves or others, we put them in Cottage K. Locked up at all times." "Emotionally disturbed patients here? Don't they belong in psychiatric hospitals?" "Oh, sure," he said. "But it's a difficult thing to control. Some, the borderline emotionally disturbed, don't break down until after they've been here for a while. Others were committed by the courts, and we had no choice but to admit them, even though there's really no room for them. The real problem is that there's no room for anyone anywhere. Do you know how long our own waiting list is? 1,400. And we may have room for 25 or 30 of them by the end of the year."
"Where are those 1,400 now?"
"Home. On the outside, waiting for an opening here or in some other institution. You see, our space problem is not like the usual hospital overcrowding. Our patients usually come here to stay for the rest of their lives."
As we arrived at the new school building, a one-story glass and concrete structure with large picture windows, I tried to imagine what it would be like walking through these corridors as a patient. I visualized myself in the middle of a line of men and boys waiting to enter a classroom. Perhaps I'd be one of those pushing another boy in a wheelchair, or guiding someone else by the hand, or cuddling a smaller boy in my arms. In one of the woodworking classrooms, where a group of older boys were making benches under a teacher's supervision, they clustered around us, eyeing me curiously. The teacher put down the saw and came towards us.
"This is Mr. Gordon from Beekman University," said Winslow. "Wants to look over some of our patients. He's thinking of buying the place."
The teacher laughed and waved at his pupils.
"Well, if he buys it, he's got to take us with it. And he's got to get us some more wood to work with."
As he showed me around the shop, I noticed how strangely quiet the boys were. They went on with their work of sanding or varnishing the newly finished benches, but they didn't talk.
"These are my silent boys, you know," he said, as if he sensed my unspoken question. "Deaf mutes."
"We have 106 of them here," explained Winslow, "as a special study sponsored by the federal government."
What an incredible thing. How much less they had than other human beings. Mentally retarded, deaf, mute, and still eagerly sanding benches.
One of the boys, who had been tightening a block of wood in a vise, stopped what he was doing, tapped Winslow on the arm, and pointed to the corner where a number of finished objects were drying on display shelves. The boy pointed to a lamp base on the second shelf, and then to himself. It was a poor job, unsteady, the patches of wood filler showing through, and the varnish heavy and uneven. Winslow and the teacher praised it enthusiastically, and the boy smiled proudly and looked at me, waiting for my praise, too.
"Yes," I nodded, mouthing the words exaggeratedly. "Very good, very nice."
I said it because he needed it, but I felt hollow. The boy smiled at me, and when we turned to leave, he came over and touched my arm as a way of saying goodbye. It choked me up, and I had a great deal of difficulty controlling my emotions until we were out in the corridor again. The principal of the school was a short, plump, motherly lady who sat me down in front of a neatly lettered chart showing the various types of patients, the number of faculty assigned to each category, and the subjects they studied.
Of course, she explained, we don't get many of the upper IQs anymore. They're taken care of, the 60 and 70 IQs, more and more in the city schools and special classes, or else there are community facilities for caring for them.
Most of the ones we get are able to live out in foster homes, boarding houses, and do simple work on the farms or in a menial capacity in factories or laundries.
Or bakeries, I suggested. She frowned.
Yes, I guess they might be able to do that. Now, we also classify our children. I call them all children, no matter what their ages are. They're all children here. We classify them as tidy or untidy. It makes the administration of their cottages a lot easier if they can be kept with their own levels. Some of the untidies are severely brain-damaged cases, kept in cribs, and they will be cared for that way for the rest of their lives.
Or until science finds a way to help them. Oh, she smiled, explaining to me carefully, I'm afraid these are beyond help. No one is beyond help. She peered at me, uncertainly now.
Yes, yes, of course you're right. We must have hope.
I made her nervous. I smiled to myself at the thought of how it would be if they brought me back here as one of her children. Would I be tidy or not? Back at Winslow's office, we had coffee as he talked about his work.
It's a good place, he said. We have no psychiatrists on our staff, only an outside consulting man who comes in once every 2 weeks. But it's just as well. Everyone on the psych staff is dedicated to his work. I could have hired a psychiatrist, but at the price I'd have to pay, I'm able to hire two psychologists, men who aren't afraid to give away a part of themselves to these people.
What do you mean by a part of themselves? He studied me for a moment, and then through the tiredness flashed an anger. There are a lot of people who will give money or materials, but very few who will give time and affection. That's what I mean. His voice grew harsh, and he pointed to an empty baby bottle on the bookshelf across the room.
You see that bottle?
I told him I had wondered about it when we came into his office.
Well, how many people do you know who are prepared to take a grown man into his arms and let him nurse with the bottle, and take the chance of having the patient urinate or defecate all over him?
You look surprised. You can't understand it, can you? From way up there in your research ivory tower?
What do you know about being shut out from every human experience as our patients have been?
I couldn't restrain a smile, and he apparently misunderstood because he stood up and ended the conversation abruptly. If I come back here to stay and he finds out the whole story, I'm sure he'll understand. He's the kind of man who would. As I drove out of Warren, I didn't know what to think. The feeling of cold grayness was everywhere around me, a sense of resignation.
There had been no talk of rehabilitation, of cure, of someday sending these people out into the world again. No one had spoken of hope. The feeling was of living death, or worse, of never having been fully alive and knowing. Souls withered from the beginning and doomed to stare into the time and space of every day.
I wondered about the house mother with her red blotched face, and the stuttering shop teacher, and the motherly principal, and the youthful, tired-looking psychologist, and wished I knew how they had found their way here to work and dedicate themselves to these silent minds. Like the boy who held the younger one in his arms, each had found a fulfillment in giving away a part of himself to those who had less. And what about the things I wasn't shown? I may soon be coming to Warren to spend the rest of my life with the others, waiting.
July 15th. I've been putting off a visit to my mother. I want to see her, and I don't. Not until I'm sure what is going to happen to me. Let's see first how the work goes and what I discover. Algernon refuses to run the maze anymore. General motivation has decreased. I stopped off again today to see him, and this time Strauss was there, too. Both he and Niemer looked disturbed as they watched Bert force-feed him. Strange to see the little puff of white clamped down on the work table, and Bert forcing the food down his throat with an eyedropper. If it keeps up this way, they'll have to start feeding him by injection. Watching Algernon squirm under those tiny bands this afternoon, I felt them around my own arms and legs. I started to gag and choke, and I had to get out of the lab for fresh air. I've got to stop identifying with him. I went down to Murray's bar and had a few drinks, and then I called Faye and we made the rounds. Faye is annoyed that I've stopped taking her out dancing, and she got angry and walked out on me last night. She has no idea of my work and no interest in it, and when I do try to talk to her about it, she makes no attempt to hide her boredom. She just can't be bothered, and I can't blame her. She's interested in only three things that I can see: dancing, painting, and sex. The only thing we really have in common is sex. It's foolish of me to try to interest her in my work. So she goes dancing without me. She told me that the other night she dreamed she had come into the apartment and set fire to all my books and notes, and that we went off dancing around the flames. I've got to watch out. She's becoming possessive. I just realized tonight that my own place is starting to resemble her apartment. A mess. I've got to cut down on the drinking.
This ends Disc 6.